Really, I just want to know who you are and how Detroit made you who you are.
Okay. I guess I can start off with my name. My name is Kevin David Ziegler. That's the name I was born with. I'm a lifetime Detroiter. I was born just maybe a mile or so at Henry Ford Hospital up the street. I'm the second of four children, two boys and two girls. My parents, my father was from Albany, Georgia. My mother was born here. They came here from the South when he was probably like 15 or so. And, you know, we were all raised here in Detroit. Educated in the public school system, which I won't say is great, because I was talking to somebody yesterday about history. And I'm thinking, like, you know, I don't know anything about history, you know. History, I feel like I missed a lot in the public school system. But, you know, I got what I got, and I think that's part of what makes me who I am, you know.
Is there a strength that you think that the public school systems might not be amazing, but was there a segment or a subject that they really gave you a good idea about? Or a good teacher maybe that you had?
I was thinking about that. You know, school really pretty much for me was uneventful. I don't think there was any desire to like really learn or, you know, what this really is about. I don't think I really had a lot of teachers that even made me feel that way, particularly in junior high school, but maybe a little bit more in high school. Well, high school. When I went to Chadsey High School, which is on the west side, it wasn't in my neighborhood. It was a really dynamically diverse school.
Diverse in what way?
Diverse in that there were Hispanic kids there. There were Polish kids there. There were black kids there. That neighborhood had a heavy Ukraine kind of population back at that time. And this school was just, it was just a hodgepodge of everything. I mean, there were, you know, Black Panthers there. There were White Panthers there. It was a really different kind of place. It wasn't like, they didn't have a great sports team, so they ranked like zero. But it was that was a good experience going there, because I was just doing terribly up to that point. But when I got to Chadsey, I kind of thought, oh, this group is a little different. They're kind of like thinking, so I guess maybe it has. I made the honor roll for the first time at Chadsey. You'd never make the honor roll. Never, never, never. I made the honor roll in Chadsey for whatever I took. I did really good in the coursework I took, you know.
Do you think it was the environment?
I think it was totally the environment there, yeah. I always feel like now that nobody benefits by living secludedly. If you're Arab, if you're Jewish, if you're white, if you're black, if you're mixing, if every, which is kind of like Detroit, if everybody's kind of living in their own corner and there's no mixture, you don't get nothing.
It's true.
You only get what you got.
That's true.
When you throw it, it was a completely different experience. Yeah. So, yeah, that was, Chadsey was a good experience for me. I'm glad I went to school there too.
That's great. And so is that the first place where you saw any gay or lesbian or queer people?
At Chadsey, no, that wasn't, you know, that probably was out of my mind. I'd put that out of my mind probably, I think when we moved, when my parents got their first home, we moved from our flat in 1966, I think I was 10 or 11, and when we moved to this new neighborhood, I figured out really it was going to be different. Now, I figured out before we moved there that there was something going on, because there was somebody that I liked on our street, Howard. And, you know, I really didn't think about that I was going to move away and we're going to move, and I think we're going to move to a new house, we're going to move to a new neighborhood. But, I mean, probably a couple of weeks after we had moved, I thought, like, you know, I'm not going to see Howard anymore.
Yeah.
So
So you felt sadness?
Yeah, I did. So much so that I asked my father was going grocery shopping. I asked my father to take me back over to, could I go over on Waverly because the supermarket was close to there. And you dropped me off at Mrs. Jones's house and I can play with Kevin and them, you know. So he said, okay.
Yeah.
So he dropped me off there and I spent the whole time working in the neighborhood trying to find Howard.
Yeah.
The whole time. It was, couldn't find him anywhere.
How old were you?
I was 10.
10, yeah.
When I finally found him, mm-hmm. I hear Miss Jones hollering, Kevin, Kevin. Like, what? Wait a minute. So I run back to the house, you know. I said, oh, don't go anywhere. Stay right here, you know. And I went back in. My father had been in an accident, and it was like,
oh my God.
And smashed the car. He ran into a DOT bus. It was like, it was pandemonium.
Yeah.
And I never got to see Howard again after that. So when I got to a new address, it was a whole different set of boys. Mm-hmm. I think it was there. I know people were, I was getting it. Even when I lived on Waverly, but there it was really, I knew I was different because mm-hmm. everybody was telling me I was different.
Who was telling you?
You know, kids, you know, babysitter. Mm-hmm. I always think that, and I wrote it down, I kind of felt like everybody had already, they started defining me mm-hmm. before I had even time to define myself. Mm-hmm. People were saying things about me before I could even get a grasp, and I was 10 years old, you know, I was getting it from the babysitter. You act like a little girl, you do this, you do that, you know, at school maybe. I thought, and I'm trying to think about all these questions, and I could think about little incidents where things would happen, and I was thinking like boys, you know, that maybe I didn't even know or anything like that, you know, and they'd just come down the hall or something and push me down or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was starting to get that message, you know, punk, sissy. So, you know, you start getting those messages really early. As mm-hmm. soon as everybody finds out you're a little different.
Yeah.
So I hadn't defined gay or lesbian or anything, even the time that I, you know, was fooling around with Howard, you know. I thought we were doing what everybody else was doing, you know, so I never had to talk about it or anything like that. I was going to say, like, you know, I like Howard. Me and Howard were kissing in the garage or something like that, or hugging or something like that. I didn't think anything.
Yeah.
About it. I didn't think anything about it until, you know, I moved over there and I was getting older, 11, 12, 13, 14. Then I started thinking, like, okay, this is like, you know, this is going to be difficult. Mm-hmm. And then where I get my real reference point is I was passed at the Tower Theater on Grand River on Easter Sunday. We went there to see, you know, on Easter Sunday you got dressed up. And these are things I miss about Detroit.
Yeah.
On Easter Sunday, the whole neighborhood, everybody having their Easter clothes. Mm-hmm. They were going to church. It's just been erased now. That doesn't happen anymore. People don't go to church. You don't see the kids out on the street. But we went to the movie theater that day. It was a movie, The Detectives, with Frank Sinatra and Lee Remick.
Okay.
And this plot was something where this detective was dealing with this homicidal maniac. He was killing people, and he was killing homosexuals. At the movie, everybody's like screaming and laughing and everything. And when I heard the word, I kind of went down.
You knew that was you at that point.
Oh, God. I was destroyed. I was destroyed that day. I remember going home. I was crying and everything. I was like, oh, fuck.
Could you pinpoint why? Was it like a lightning bolt you knew immediately, or was it confusion?
It was the word. So I knew, because there was something that happens in the movie, and one guy tries to put the make on this guy, and the guy kills him, you know. Mm. So I'm thinking like, oh, that's what you're doing. You're homosexual. So it was negative.
Was that your first clear, that's who I am?
That was my, that there was a word for it.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't have a word for it or anything like that before that. Nobody said, I didn't, you know, there was nobody gay very much around my neighborhood or anything that I could tell or anything like that.
You never saw anyone who you were like, oh, they kind of act like how other people say I act?
Mm. Probably not. No, I think I was more focused on myself. I don't think I recognize other people.
Yeah. So you really did feel like the only one in the world.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I felt like I don't feel like anybody else was getting that designation, you know, in class or in school or anything like that. I mean, later on, maybe I kind of, when I got to high school, I could kind of pick those up, but before that, no, you know. So that was the first, when I got that. And then, and I probably was 13, say 14 or 15, that's when I like, all right, this door is closed. And I locked it out. Till I went to college. And
what made you lock it out? You didn't want to be that thing in the movie?
Yes, yes, yeah. Right. So I closed it. This door is closed. Mm-hmm. Messing around with anybody in the neighborhood, a possibility of that, that's done. Okay. So I shut that door.
How did you shut that door?
I just, like, turned it off.
Okay.
I turned the gay switch up, off.
Did you change your behaviors, or is it mental?
I always tried to change my behavior. I always would try to fit in with everybody, but it just... It just never did. If I did it, you know, I knew I was being a fake or a phony.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel right. You know, if I tried to get in trouble or hang out with the other guys, it just didn't. It never worked.
This reminds me so much of that article that you wrote in the Journal of Self-Help and Self-Care,
mm-hmm.
the Mankind Project.
Right.
You wrote something about how you would use a mask to navigate uncomfortable situations, and doing that pulled you away from being present.
Right.
And it dissociated you, and it dimmed your internal light. Those were your words.
Totally it did, because I would, like, wherever, you know, I'd go in a situation, all right, this is a green situation. Green.
Yeah.
I totally become the green, or I try as best I could.
Mm-hmm.
It was a red situation. All right, you got to be red here. All right. I was like a chameleon, and it took a long time I think it really diminished my inner light, yeah.
And how long did this last?
I think for a long time. I mean, there's probably some scant bits of it, you know, present now, but for the most part, yeah, I think it always flickered a little bit, but I think I kind of, like, got control of it when I recognized what I was doing.
Hmm. When did you see that it was a negative thing?
Probably I had a roommate one time, and I was hanging out with some Rastas or something like that. And I remember we were doing something, and I said, well, hey, you know, I'm getting ready to leave. I'm going over here to Hassan's house, you know. I'm just going to go over there and, like, you know, maybe cop a bag of weed or something like that and hang out with them. And I remember him saying, Kevin, I don't know why you going over there. I was Kevin then. I hadn't quite embraced the Tiba yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what do you mean? He said, man, those guys don't like you. They know who you are. They ain't thinking about you. You come in here, maybe you bring money over there, you do that, they kind of like fool around. You thinking they're your friends. They're not your friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really mad with Kelvin that day. So I went on to, to Hassan's house. And that day, there were some other guys there, and they were talking, and they just happened to start talking about gay people and, like, talking about them really badly. And I was, like, right there in the
room.
These
are Rastafarians?
They weren't Rastafarians.
Oh, okay.
I thought they were Rastas at that time.
They're not,
you know,
from Jamaica. No, West
no,
Indies.
No.
Okay.
They were Rasta wannabes from Detroit. So I remember him sitting there and saying that, and then Calvin's words just coming back to me, and I'm thinking, like, this is a gray situation, so you're sitting here being gray, and, you know, you're not going to say anything, you're just going to play along, like, oh, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I never went back over to his house again, so I think that's when I started beginning, like, okay, he was right, he was right, so you're going to do this everywhere you go. Then I started thinking, like, okay, I'm going to have to, like, not do this anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of stopped being in situations so much where I thought, if I thought that was going on, I wouldn't be in it. Or if I thought they didn't really care for me, or there was reason why they were just kind of dealing with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would start meeting some people who just kind of accept me or who I was, you know. They didn't really care that maybe I was gay or possibly, and I really hadn't maybe I had kind of started to define it when I started coming, when I came back to school here after I left Ferris. Then I had friends who I thought, like, you know, it was probably okay if I didn't say anything, you know, but they weren't intimidated by me or anything. My friend John, who is from the East Coast, he, and I met him here at Wayne State, I think he just kind of, when I met him, I could tell that it didn't matter whether I was gay or not, even if I hadn't defined it. I think he had an idea, but he was cool with it because he was okay with who he was, so it didn't matter. So I don't think I really, it's so much to talk about, but there was this big thing, probably when I left college, you know, there were issues there. I still had kind of like shut it down. I had a girlfriend in college for about 3 years, but mm-hmm. it was still there when I was even dating her. Mm-hmm. It was always in the back of my head. So I came to Detroit. I got an officialship at Frank Murphy Hall of Justice. I was a court stenographer there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of things, I was really struggling with it there, you know. And I probably was this close short of a nervous breakdown at one time there. Mm-hmm. And I asked to have some time off from work.
Yeah, and it was just this buildup over
years.
Yes.
Yeah. I asked for some time off of work. Yeah. I went and got a therapist. Mm-hmm. And just kind of started working on it, started to tear it down.
What year was this now?
This was probably in between 79 and probably 83, because I got the officialship in 1979.
Okay. That's pretty progressive, going to see a therapist.
Yeah, yeah,
what
at that time.
Did you seek that out? Did you know someone who had done that?
No, but I did it at Ferris.
Okay.
Because
okay.
of the same thing. I knew that it was... And I was like, the door is closed. So I started seeing a therapist there.
What was their response to you? Because it might not be the best response to a homosexual. That
right.
was still considered a disease.
Yeah, Dr. Capita was pretty kind of cool. He wasn't, you know, I don't think I actually was saying it. I probably was like kind of masking it. Yeah. I was talking about it, but I was talking about it kind of under here. Yeah. I wasn't really saying it, but, you know, and then he put me in an encounter group or a group therapy group, and that didn't work really well, so I didn't stay with that long. And I probably tried a couple times outside of that. I had some counseling at Herman Gardens Housing Project went before they tore it down. Mm-hmm. That didn't work so well. I don't think the guy really... But when I almost had this kind of breakdown when I was working at court, then I sought somebody else, George M. Nandi, who owns the art gallery, and he was a therapist, but he had stopped doing it. So he sent me to see, he said, I'm not doing that anymore, but I have a friend who's still doing it. You might want to go visit him. So I called him up and talked to him, and he said the same thing, like, you know, Atiba, yeah, I went to school for this, but I ain't thinking so much about this whole psychology thing. But if you want a head job, I'll give you one, but you got to pay for it.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. It was Dr. George Fleming, yeah. And he was the one who kind of got me to thinking, you know, I kind of like brought all the things out. About what was going on. He said, well, you know, I remember he kind of gave me a piece of candy. I was telling you, want a piece of candy? Sure, yeah. He said, you know what? You know, Kevin, I don't care if you like sticking a water hose up your ass. If that's what you want to do, that's what you do. It's nobody's business but yours. You know, you need to just get over it.
Yes.
You know? So it was him
that
kind of...
Was that enough, or was it you had to build from there?
I had to build from there, but that was the beginning to be, like, just the way he was just so comfortable, and he just said it, you know, as a matter of factly, you know. So you know, you come back, and we'll talk.
Yeah.
Not so, you know, it started working there, but then I was already gay, and I still was not dealing with it as well. Mm-hmm. But I saw a therapist at the University Psychiatric Center, Wayne State.
Okay.
Dr. Erin Faluca. Huh. She gave me some medication. We talked. I was done after her. Mm-hmm. And then I remember one day she came in. I said, you know, I kind of think I don't think I need to come back anymore. And she said, you know what? I don't think you do either. So it was great.
So she fixed you?
She helped. She got me together. She and Renee McCoy. Renee, I give kudos to Renee McCoy because probably when I left court, mm-hmm. I ended up walking away from that job. Mm-hmm. And I think it had a lot to do with everything I had gone through, but I needed to just kind of clear the space and do something different. But Renee started this kind of ministry for gay and lesbian African Americans who kind of been thrown out of the church. My parents weren't religious or anything like that, but I still kind of had that kind of foundation under me, or this is the way you're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But she was doing some really progressive work back then. And it wasn't, you know, her church wasn't so religious. She's really kind of given us some spiritual principles to deal with being gay and lesbian. And people are always telling us that we're not worth anything. We don't have this. But, you know, you're entitled to the same gifts that everybody else mm-hmm. is. Don't let anybody tell you differently. You're chosen, special. We're probably the best loved persons, you know, that of God's children, you know.
The opposite of saying God thinks you're an abomination. God loves you best.
Exactly the way you are. That was her thing. So, you know, so all the messy stuff you're doing out there, you know, she would like, her sermons would be so cool, you know, about like, you know, you'd be at the bar or something like that, and it's like a quarter two, and like, I'm going to find somebody at night to take home to. She would use Toni Braxton, like if love should have brought you home last night, she would do all these things. So you'd have to start thinking about what you were doing.
Yeah.
So I think that she really got a whole lot of us together. She was really tied to a community, because she came from Washington, D.C., and I think she's with the National Coalition of Lesbian Gays in Washington, D.C. So she's really hooked up to all these people there, like Cheryl Clark, you know, Essex Hemphill, Marlon Riggs, Michelle Parkinson. She'd be talking about all these people. She would have magazines that they published in D.C.
Yeah.
So we're getting all this information, and then this community starts coalescing, this black community. People start coming to the church, you know, they start organizing, like, well, let's have a Kwanzaa celebration, you know, Kwanzaa. We can't have Kwanzaa, you know, they can only do Kwanzaa at the black, surrounding the black Madonna, you know, black gay people can't celebrate Kwanzaa. And this Dr. Kofi Adoma, Emory Robinson, who's a psychologist or psychiatrist, maybe, you know, she's a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, yeah, we can celebrate Kwanzaa. So we would have Kwanzaa celebrations. Mm-hmm. Then we started making other organizations. We started the James Baldwin Pat Parker Society, which was kind of an art organization where we'd have a yearly art program where we'd have poetry, dance, art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was really kind of cool. We when 56 was on 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff came out of Renee's church, too.
Wow.
They were going to show Tongues Untied on the PBS stations, but Detroit said no, it was too risque. And
mm-hmm.
Tongues Untied was a film that Marlon Riggs had done about being black and gay. And they were saying, like, this is not suitable for TV.
Mm-hmm.
So we staged a big boycott at Channel 56.
Right.
So all these things started pulling people together, and I think people started feeling better about who they were. I certainly did, and I attribute a lot of that to what Renee did for the community, and, you know, I think that really kind of, her, you know, and all those things stacked together kind of helped me kind of solidify that, you know, I was all right and who I was, and, you know, I could move from there. I didn't have to be, you know, feeling bad about being gay anymore, you know, or sad about it, that there was something wrong with me or anything like that. And I could just totally throw the whole church thing out the window. And, I, you know, I have a spiritual life, certainly, but a lot of the stuff that I, you know, hear and see, I just, like, I kind of reject. It's like, okay, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure about any of this. When I said, you know, I don't know about history as much as I should, but I think for the most part, most people, we're listening to what somebody else is telling us. And if we think that they're smarter, we accept it as truth,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to finding out for ourselves. Really?
That's right.
Yeah. You know, a classic example is talk about the feeding of the masses when Jesus fed the the masses with two loaves and a couple of fish. And I used to think as a kid, well, like, what did he do? He tore a piece of the fish off and then it would just grow back. So every time you tear a piece off and give somebody, it would just grow back. Mm-hmm. You tear the bread off and it would just like go back to a full loaf again.
It's magic.
Right, yeah, I thought it was magic.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking like, oh, Tima, that didn't happen. Like he fed him, he did this, he prayed over the food and it multiplied. And I tell people now, I told a lady who comes pick up bread at the bakery, I said, that's not what happened. I said, what he did, Jesus came, he was that kind of magnetic personality. He's just like, hey, you know, what do you have over there? I got some pita bread. Bring it over here. Hey, what about you over there? Nico, what do you have? I got some tacos. Mm-hmm. What about you? You know, Audrey, what do you got? I got some collard greens. Everybody was so, the little that they had that they probably just put together. He brought all these people together, and then they had so much food, so it multiplied. It was magic. And they said, no, Tiba, get away from me.
That's not what the Bible says.
Right. So I can kind of just, I said, you know, I don't take it literally anymore. Okay. I think it's meant to tell us some things. Everything in that book is not true. Or it didn't happen exactly that way, you
right.
know.
It's written a long time.
Right, yeah.
I don't know exactly.
And nobody, you didn't see nobody write it. Yeah.
Well, that sounds, how you describe that, the fish and loaf situation, that sounds what Reverend Dr. Renee McCoy was doing. She was bringing everyone together and they were contributing.
And she did that, yeah. She really built a community. And I mean, other organizations, there were people who didn't come to the church either, but they were starting to like, things were spinning off from that little hurricane eye that she was doing.
Yeah, they wanted to get in there,
go to the church. Yeah, exactly. Okay. A lot of them probably wouldn't admit that, but I really think that's really what happened. Yeah.
Well, she sounded like she was pretty open about it. Like, she didn't hold fast rules where you have to believe in Jesus Christ.
No, that wasn't her thing.
Yeah.
And she, Renee really took care. And it was like at the height of HIV, when it was just starting and everything, Renee probably eulogized and buried, like I said, most of those guys that died, you know, because their parents, you know, wouldn't have anything to do with them. I mean, she would sit by their bed. I remember her telling us one Sunday, she said, you know, if any of your friends are like sick, she said, you know, if you know they're sick and they're not going, she said, you should go there. And you should sit by their bedside, she said, and you should not leave until they, you know, give up their last breath. She said, there's something about that experience. She said, I can't tell you. Mm-hmm. It's a phenomenal experience. She said, it's something that we all should experience. She said, you know, don't deprive yourself that opportunity. I remember her telling us that, you know. But she would do it a lot. Sometimes she would just break down on Sunday morning because she would stay with somebody all night, and this person died. And a lot of those people would come to the church at the end, you know, because they didn't have any place else to go, you know. So, yeah. So she really took care of a lot of people. She did a lot during that time. I kind of felt like the broader community never honored her for what she did. Because that was significant. And I know a lot of these other churches weren't doing, they weren't doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting because she came in from outside Detroit.
Right.
She really enriched Detroit.
Right. She was originally a Detroiter.
Yeah.
She was originally a Detroiter. She lived right down the street from, my parents knew her as a little girl.
Really? Yeah. Oh, so she came as a little girl. Well, then
she lived on my dad's street. My father used to drink with her father and everything. So she was a neighborhood girl, yeah.
Oh, but
she went to D.C., yeah.
Yes.
And then she came back from D.C. and stayed here. Now she's gone to Seattle.
Oh,
yeah. She's living in Seattle now. Yeah. But she's a significant person in my coming out experience and becoming whole, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So when you look back to little Kevin, what's different now?
What's different now? God, there's a lot of things now. I don't think I hate myself as much as I hated. I don't think I really liked myself when I was little because I was getting all these messages. It really made me feel bad about myself for a long time, for a long time. So when I look back at that,
Were these messages all to do with you act like a girl or you're different? There's something we can't pinpoint, or was it other things?
Yeah, it was mostly that, or you know, you're not, you know, even in school, you know, you're not smart enough.
Yeah.
Oh, if you're not good at sports, you're not as agile as other people. You know, you're not that.
Yeah.
My thing is that whole thing about, you know, being smart. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's so many people that are probably, where does that word come from? Being smart. What does that mean?
I've never thought about it. Yeah.
And that certain kids get told that, and other kids don't get told that.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of impacted me, too. I was really bad at math. I just could not get math for anything. And mm-hmm. I always felt stupid because of it. And I remember making a decision in the third grade that I would give up on math because I just couldn't get it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why I have kind of this sour taste in my mouth about the Detroit public school system or public school systems in general. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it happens a lot. I would think even in private schools, too.
Right.
I think education, and it's what you're saying, what we tell kids, you know, you're over here,
right.
You're not over here. And
right.
That shuts the door. Like you
right.
were saying, you turn that switch.
Right,
and then
yeah.
You can't go there anymore.
Right.
Your mind won't let you. It doesn't mean you're not capable.
Exactly, exactly. But and I think even my sister, my oldest sister, same thing with her. I think she got told, oh, she's not smart, she's not this, she's not that. So I think she just kind of bought it. She never did anything. So.
And that was your experience in most Detroit schools?
Most Detroit schools.
Yeah.
Except for maybe when I got to Chadsey, I didn't hear those messages. But everywhere else, yeah, I definitely got them. And the kids who were excelling, they got the attention. And if you weren't excelling, you didn't get any attention.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same in gym. Mm-hmm. If you're like one of those kids who displayed like athletic prowess, you were good, you got attention. If you didn't, you go off, you just in this corner and they didn't work with you or anything. They didn't really care what you did, you know.
Yeah. Well, what did you get attention for? Did you excel at anything in the eyes of these?
I don't think so. I think I kind of like art, which but I don't think anybody really kind of focused on it or anything. Mm-hmm. Writing was my thing. And there was one time where one of my teachers put me in a creative writing class, but I don't know what happened. It just kind of like petered out.
Yeah.
And I never kind of went back to it, but I think that was really what I probably should have done. I probably should have done journalism, but I just never, I could never figure out what I felt like I never, because of my experience at school, I never was able to quite figure out what am I supposed to do? What am I here to do? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm 62. I mean, I'm doing what I'm doing now, but I'm not quite sure I've really found, like, well, what do I want to be when I grow up?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to figure that out. Yeah. But it's kind of cool because I've been all over the place. You know?
That's true.
Trying to find that. Yeah.
And so right now you're at Avalon?
I'm at Avalon. Okay. I've been there like 7 years now.
And what do you do there?
I'm a barista, but I just started as a customer service person. When you come in the store, just, you know, pull your order together.
Yeah.
So now I went to a barista training maybe a couple of years ago. So I've kind of gotten really good with that. So I'm kind of managing their coffee program, which is kind of cool. But, you know, it's like I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
I don't think Avalon is going to be where I'm going to be at, but I don't really know what the next step is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That article that you wrote, you said something about you had a long-standing desire to give back to your community based on your skills and experience. So how have you done that?
How have I done? I think I did a lot of that just being involved with, you know, the church, being involved with building some organizations. I actually was on the board or was at the initial meeting that helped to develop Ruthella Center.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I felt like I really did that. The work I did with the church, I did a lot of work with Renee. I did work with James Baldwin Pat Parker Society.
Yeah.
I worked a lot in building that organization and kind of being a grunt worker there, but I think I was integral to that. What I really like to do now, I think, what I'd like to give back, you know, I'm kind of into yoga. I'm not like a yoga head or anything like that, but I saw this program, and happens in Baltimore. It's a program where they teach yoga to children.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, you know, that would be really cool to be able to teach that to children, teach them meditation and have a couple hours where, you know, like, hey, they come into class and we just sit down, we're going to be quiet, we're going to do some stretches, you know, so we're just going to bring it down. I would love to be able to do something like that that gives back to kids, that gives kids a space to, like, center themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And
they've got noise in their head.
Yeah, just like I did. And they'd be able to quiet that noise. Yeah. But I'd like to do something like that. I mean, I want to do something. And I think I do that at Avalon. I think what I do at Avalon is I do Dharma work at Avalon, you know. You know, some people, I have conversations with people. I listen to people.
That goes such a long way.
I give them coffee.
Yeah.
We've had some issues with homeless people and begging and stuff like that, you know. And it's, you know, I have a lot of mixed feelings about that, you know. But I sent a letter to the CEO of the company and said, look, you know, we really got to do something because this guy comes in there every day. He's like begging, and actually a staff person. We got in an argument because he wanted to throw the guy out. And I said, yeah. And he says, Motiba, you know, I need you to do it. I said, but that's not my job to throw them out because they're bothering, you know, the people, the paying customers. I understand that. But why do I have to do that? He's black. I'm black. He's poor. I'm sort of poor. I'm doing better than he's doing. But, you know. Why do I have to be the overseer, or I got to be the bad guy and do this? Because this is not my business. I know they, you know, people have to say, no, I can't give you any money, but people do it. So we got in a big argument because I told him it wasn't my job. He said it was my job. So I see that is an issue. So I sent her a letter and said, you know, we got a problem here. I don't feel comfortable approaching these people. I don't think it's right for me to approach these people. These people are in need. We can look at them and tell that they're in need. Can we sit down and talk about this? And then, you know, we can go to Midtown Detroit and all these businesses down here. We can sit down and we can construct a plan. All these people have moved in here. You got people living in $500,000 lost. Now, we can't kind of impact this situation. I'm not saying we're going to solve the problem, but we can impact it. Can we sit down and talk about this? So she said, we can't do it this week, but next week. And I really want to kind of be able to spearhead it because this one guy he wants to throw out, I look at him, I see him as a person who's really in need. And if he's not in need, there's something where he's coming up short. Mm-hmm. There should be some kind of way where we can figure out where you're coming up short. Is there something we can do for you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if we can and you allow us to, fine. But if we offer it to you and you don't take it, then I think we can say, all right, no, you can't stand out here and panhandle. We offered you this. We did this. We asked you to do this. Mm-hmm. We tried. We just can't just throw them out and say, get out of here and, you know, go down the street. So does that solve the problem?
Yeah.
And just go around the corner and then a day or two, they're going to be right back doing the same thing again.
Because you haven't solved the problem.
Yeah.
And so he's not the only one.
He's not the only one. So I want to be able to make, I want to do work like that.
Okay.
That's the kind of work I want to do.
Respond?
She responded very positively, and the manager sent me an email too and said, yeah, I really think this is really crucial because I think we're at a tipping point. Mm-hmm. I said, because there's all these people coming. I've never seen these people before. Where are they coming from? But they're coming to this corner because they know people here have money. They know people are buying this bread. They know that they're coming in these businesses, you know. Yeah. And people are just giving the money because they don't want to be bothered with them. Just here, take the money, get out of my face, you know. That's not really going to help them. Maybe we can figure out something, you know. I thought we can figure out who they are, you know. What's your story? Mm-hmm. All right, we got his story. Okay, this is what's going on. Maybe housing, da-da-da-da. Let's steer him. So I think those kind of things are things that I've done in the community, and those are the kind of things that I want to continue to do in the community. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to just make it a better place. I want to make it better for me, but I want to make it better for everybody, for those kids.
Yeah.
There's a Head Start program in my neighborhood, too. I need to go over there.
Yeah.
I talked to somebody with the Community Foundation, and she said, well, you know, you better be really careful when you approach these people. And I'm thinking, like, why? Well, you know, you're a guy, and you kind of, you know what people think about men who want to be around children. Just like, I was furious about that.
Yeah, it's a bummer. It's part of our society. It's a problem that we have to deal with too.
I was furious about that. All right, I said, okay, so if I say I want to help kids, that's what people are gonna say. They're probably gonna say he's a little gay. He's got earrings in his ear. Maybe not him.
When you were working with the Rubella Center,
mm-hmm.
you're working with young people then, not quite children maybe, mm-hmm. but more teenagers.
Right.
And did that feel fulfilling? Did you feel like you were kind of healing yourself at the same time?
I think I started out feeling that way.
Okay.
But then ultimately, I think I didn't have the skills that mm-hmm. I probably needed to have to do that work. And that was something that was new, that was starting. It hadn't been done before. What we thought we were going to do is house them. We're going to, you know, get an old abandoned house. We're going to fix this house up. We're going to, like, put them in a really nice place where they're going to, all their needs are going to be met. And, oh, God, it didn't work like that at all.
No, what happened?
It was really difficult. Again, I say that I'm not sure I was equipped. I wasn't a social worker. Mm-hmm. It's just based on what I did in the community, and I stayed with the organization while we were trying to get the grants and everything, you know, pulling things together, you know, doing grunt work, doing all the stuff to get the center going. Mm-hmm. So we finally got the house completed. The house was beautiful. We got the drop-in center, and there were issues there with the drop-in center, but it was right on the corner of Grove and Woodward.
Okay.
Which is right in the middle of that time, probably. You know, it was the kind of, you know, what was left of that once thriving gay community there.
Wow, yeah.
But it was everything else, you know, prostitution, you know, everything, drugs, you know, deja vu, the topless bar. Everything was right there on that corner where we were trying to serve the kids. So I don't think we had all the tools that we needed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly realize now that I didn't have the tools. That I wanted to try to treat the kids like my parents treated me, to some kind of that authority. I'm the adult. You listen to me. You do.
Yeah.
And those kids had experienced so much. My life was cake compared to theirs. The little stuff that I went through. They could have done that with their hands shackled behind mm-hmm. their back. It would have been nothing for them to walk through.
Yeah.
They had been through some stuff. So I think it didn't go is where I ultimately got terminated from that job because they said I wasn't able to push the program mm-hmm. forward. I worked there for 3 years. But I worked like 60 hours a week, 70 hours a week there trying to make that work. I busted my ass there.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it didn't work out like I thought it was. But I tried. I gave it my best.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did make an impact mm-hmm. On the program there. We did a lot of good things there.
Yeah.
We did a lot of good things for the youth there. Like we had a feeding program there.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to run programming there when they were accessible to it, you know. Yeah, I mean, we did a lot for them. You know, we provided food for them. We tried to provide a program. Our program would be competing with the stuff going on outside the door because that was more exciting to them.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times we didn't know what was going on. They would come to the center during limited hours during, you know, the day, and by 9 o'clock, you know, when we closed the doors, they probably, a lot of them had to go back to wherever they were. We did get some kids in the house, and that was successful to some degree, but, you know, okay. we had problems at the house too, you know.
Yeah.
Big problems at the house. But, I mean, you know, they had an opportunity. Some kids did okay.
What were the main problems?
The main problems were probably just their histories and not having a lot of parental involvement and, you know, where they had to listen to somebody or they'd been mm-hmm. tossed around. Probably foster home to foster home, you
so
know. So
follow rules.
Yeah, so, you know, and just being at that age, and
yeah.
plus being gay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was a lot for them, you know, and we couldn't just devote 24 hours to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I did what I did. I did my best. I probably made some mistakes. I probably did make some mistakes. It took me a long time to come to that. Probably the executive director is well intentioned as she was at the time. I think she made great mistakes.
Hmm.
Great mistakes. At the end, they really tried to trash her really bad, but it's like, hey, she brought what she had to the table, and nobody can say that she did some good work here.
Mm-hmm.
She did some good work. She did some, we you know, tons of stuff. We buried a couple kids. I mean, we gave them send-offs you wouldn't believe, collected money, made things happen
mm-hmm.
that was that their families couldn't even do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we took them places sometime when we could. I think we did a great job.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, we just showed them, like, you can do something else. It doesn't have to be like this. And you know, maybe at Kwanzaa celebration a couple years ago, I run into somebody every now and then and say, Atiba, you know, we really loved you, Atiba. You know, yeah, you kind of gave it to us. You were giving it to us, but you know, you, the center, after you left, the center wasn't the same. So that
and
would
I
be, that was real. I said, well, I wish you could have let me know this before. So I was doing a rotten job. And a young woman at Kwanzaa. I went to Kwanzaa a couple of years ago. I was getting ready to leave. She said, before you leave, she was one of my outreach workers. And she said, before you leave, I need to talk to you. You know, she's married. She had a daughter, a son, and was doing really good. She said, I just want to tell you, you know, Atiba, when I was at the center working with you, you know, I was really young. I did some stupid things. I said some stupid things about you. You know, you really did a good job. I really appreciate everything you tried to teach me and everything. So that, I think when she did that, I think I felt like, okay, I feel, what's the word you want to use? Exonerated, you know,
yes.
for my termination. Yeah, I felt really good. But when they turned, the day they told me I was gone, I was sad because
yeah.
I just bought a house. It was like, I was saving this house. But I was like, and then when I told my parents, I went over to their house and said, well, you know, I got terminated from my job. And that was my mother's thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank God. What do you mean, thank God? She says, honey, have you looked at yourself in the mirror lately?
Mm-hmm.
You look terrible. So I remember I took some pictures. I was going to get a passport to go somewhere. I looked at those pictures and said, oh, my God, yeah, I did look. People would start telling me that at the end.
Yeah.
Atiba,
that's hard work.
Do you need a
for
job?
Anyone.
One lady was talking to a friend, and she was talking to a friend, and she's kind of looking over at me, and then she kind of told, "I'll be right." She just looked at me. Hey, darling, how you doing? She said, "Atiba, what? Do you need that job that bad?" I said, what are you talking about? And she got mad. She said, don't do me like that. She said, you look terrible. You need to give it up. Something's gonna hit.
Mm-hmm.
I never forget that. Yeah, she said, don't talk. Don't act like that with me. You're gonna make me mad. She said, do you need that job that bad?
Mm-hmm. So this is another turning point, like the
courthouse.
Yeah,
that was.
You want another nervous breakdown,
no.
You go on to the next stage.
Yeah, that was another turning point,
mm-hmm.
yeah. But, you know, I think we did great work at Ruth Ellis Center. And you know what? All I say is we laid the foundation. Now they're really strong.
Yeah.
So I said we just had to just hold it until they could take it over. When they could take it over, they took it over. You know, Laura Hughes, the new guy that's there now,
mm-hmm.
they're really they're building it up, you know, and they got the expertise, they got the brains, they got the organizational skills, they got everything that can make it rock, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Great. Yeah. So Detroit now, it's a lot different than when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
What do you love about Detroit now?
To be honest, Autumn, I've always loved this place. Okay. No matter where I go, California, my brother's there, he can't stand this place. Uh-huh. I love Detroit. As a young person, regardless of all my experience, I always love living here.
Yeah.
I love Motown, I love the music, mm-hmm. I love my neighborhoods that I grew up in. I had, you know, my parents, not educated people, but they were good folks,
mm-hmm.
you know. They gave me all that they could give me. It was great. For a while, after the riots and stuff, you know, Detroit seemed like, I thought I would move to the suburbs and everything, but I still felt like, you know, Detroit is my home. This is my place. Right now, gentrification, regardless of that,
mm-hmm.
I love what's going on in Detroit now.
Yeah.
I think this is a great place to live. It's a great place to do whatever you want to do. It's like a painting. It's a clear landscape for anything that can be done. Black folks can do it, and I think we don't need to wait for white folks. We don't need their permission to do anything. We can do whatever we want to do if we want to do it. Latino. It's an open canvas, and I love working in Midtown. I like living in Corktown. I live in a really diverse neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's diverse.
Mm-hmm.
It's got all kinds. It's a hodgepodge, and that's what makes it really powerful. Because you know, even though there's some people that are doing really well, some people who are kind of not doing so well, and some people who are like really not doing well there at all. But what I respect about them is they were there before we got there,
mm-hmm.
and they're still there, and they're still there. So it like they got a little flavor, they got a little nutmeg and salt
yes.
and pepper, and they're adding it. They make the neighborhood what it is, you know.
Yeah.
So I really like what's going on here. I like the restaurants. I love the people that are coming in. Sometimes I feel like an outsider.
Hmm.
But I think Detroit has a lot to offer. It's had a lot to offer me. It's made me who I am. How could I not love this place?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm, you know, I think I'm a pretty awesome person.
Yes.
I think I'm a pretty awesome person. I think I turned out great. Even when I heard the thing about the shooting at the DI, usually I would get really upset. Then I kind of heard the news and I thought, okay, this is some kids. Some kids just kind of not thinking, being kids, being 18, 19, however they were.
Yeah.
Not thinking. This is not going to color what's going on here. It's not going to make people run away and go again. If they do, that's okay. Let them go. They weren't down with it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But just like what's going on here, I mean, D-Electricity, did you go to D-Electricity at all?
No, I've never been there.
You got to go. It's a light festival they run on Woodward.
I was working that day, but I had to leave early.
Yeah.
I never got a chance to see.
Amazing. Just all the people on the street, you know, just a mixture of people on the street,
yeah.
Everybody down. I just saw some phenomenal, you know, artwork, you know, performances. So.
Oh, you're an artist yourself.
I'm an artist,
right?
Too. Yeah,
well,
I need to get busy.
Art.
My art's pretty good. I just don't trust it, you know.
And what do you trust about it?
I feel like because I didn't finish school or something like that, that doesn't make me an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have a bachelor's, I don't have an MFA, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I can't write this proposal that says, you know, all this crazy stuff about my work. My art, it's pretty abstract, some of it. I'm doing collages now. I think my work is good, Autumn.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to, like, kind of shift my energy from Avalon and be able to start focusing on it a little bit, you know.
Okay.
I think that job takes a lot of my time.
Yeah.
But if I could kind of shift my focus, you know, I could get my work out here, I think people would be interested in my work.
Mm-hmm.
I think my work is really, it has a lot to do with my experience.
Mm-hmm.
living here, my experience as a black person, my experience as a gay person, I think that's all in my work, even if it's not there literally. Mm-hmm. I think it's all intertwined in
what I do.
Probably after I did that stint with when I got the job at the courthouse, I realized court reporting, this is not going to be forever for me. Mm-hmm. So I started taking classes here. And I took one art class, then I took a photography class, and I started taking more. Then I really got into it. You know, I was here in the studio at, oh, man, like to like 4 in the morning sometime, painting or doing whatever I was doing. Yeah, but I loved it. So I, when I get some time, I do it.
Okay.
And I try to go see a lot of art, you know.
Yeah.
But everything I do is art. You know, what I do down at Avalon is art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody was arguing with me the other day, like, oh, Tiba, just pour the milk. And no, you don't just pour the milk on the cappuccino. Mm-hmm. I said, this is art. This is my art.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, whenever I set that job, I never put the lid on, let people see it. And they'll say, oh, that's beautiful. I said, you guys, you just put the top on it because you don't want them to see it.
Yes.
I want them to see it. I said, oh, that is so beautiful. You know? So that's art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my little spiritual work I get to do at the counter sometime. And some guy told me that, you know, this is, you know, Avalon, that counter is the altar of Avalon.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, people are going to dump their garbage here. They're going to give you shit. And he said, you're going to have to, like, swallow it or come up with something different. A guy came yesterday. He just walked up to the counter. And I said, I'm going to turn this thing down. You know, he walked in, and I thought, like, God. I said, what's wrong? And he said, what do you mean? I said, man, you look like you just, this weight just dropped down in front of me. And he says, oh, yeah, it's just how I'm feeling right now. You know, my dad died, you know, last Thursday. I could feel it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, man, I'm sorry about that. You know, he said, went and got, he wanted a green tea. I didn't even charge. I said, here, mm-hmm. just take the tea. I said, you know, I hope you feel better, you know.
But, mm-hmm.
So that's my art, you
yes.
know.
Yeah.
That's my art. When I front the stuff in the cooler, you know, that's my art. I'm like getting it all. Like, mm-hmm. I'm kind of obsessive compulsive that way. You know? Wow. Straight, oh, that looks really good. I look at it, you know.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so how do you think people see you? People on a day-to-day basis or who just come through the shop briefly?
I think that I don't hope I'm not sounding egotistical. I think that I'm the face of Avalon. I'm kind of the face of what they're trying to represent to the community. Yeah,
okay.
I think when people come to see me, they know I work hard there. They know I'm there to take care of them. I'm going to make them feel comfortable. Even that guy yesterday, the one that they want to throw out, I said, you know, you okay? You looking a little spacey today. You pacing a lot today. What's going on? Oh, I'm okay. All right. You know.
Yeah. And so you, at heart, you're an activist.
Mm-hmm.
Would you call yourself that?
Okay.
There's a drive in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, there is.
But it's not there every day? It comes and goes?
It comes and goes.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes I want to be the activist. Sometimes I think, like, mm-hmm. no, I just want to take care of myself.
Yeah, that's valid.
Sometimes I want to be the activist. Sometimes I want to just take care. And you just need to take care of yourself.
So you balance it.
So I try to balance it, yeah, yeah.
And what are you involved in now?
Right now, I'm just doing my work right now. Right now, this thing trying to do this thing at the bakery with the homeless, I think
yes.
I'm committed to seeing something happen with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need to be able to even connect with some customers that come in there. There's people that work with the Green Garage, which is kind of like a business incubator, I think, on 2nd Street. I think I need to connect with them and say, look, hey, you know, can I invite you guys maybe to this meeting? I need to go talk to somebody at Midtown Detroit, Sue Mosley, and say, like, hey, can we get together and just talk?
Yeah.
Talk about this situation. So I think that's my next activism piece.
Okay.
I want to kind of try to solve that situation there.
Yeah.
Not solve it, but impact it.
Or just take a first step.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That's all that's where I'm at right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else, and I'm being really activist.
Well, just to dip back into your childhood, I'm wondering, were there like any public figures or movies or songs that really inspired you and drove you to become who you are?
Public figures.
Yeah, or music or anything.
As a kid?
Mm-hmm. Or even as an adult, like on the road to becoming who you are.
As a kid, like I just think the music of Motown was very influential.
Yeah. Who are your favorites?
Probably all of them at that time, because, you know, you were just being bombarded with the Four Tops, with Martha Reeves and the Vandellas. The Supremes were at one point, but I figured the Supremes were like too gay, so I kind of closed the door on them.
Interesting.
I kind of thought, you can't identify with Diana Ross. That's a little too gay. You know what they're going to think about you if you be into the Supremes. So you got to, like, kind of close that door. And, like, now, you know, people say they're going to see Diana Ross. I think, like, really? I don't think so.
You still have that little piece in there.
I won't lie, yeah. But I think, like, Diana Ross, really?
Open that door. Maybe it's the last
time. Right. So, I mean, I think all, you know, that, yeah, I really like. And music, oh, God, well, who could I say that, I don't know.
Is there music now that you hear that you're like, oh, this is what I want to hear?
You know, I hear so much music now, it's kind of hard. Yeah. You know, it's kind of hard. There's some of the younger jazz musicians, like the Blue Note All-Stars. There's Robert Glasper, who's a pianist. Mm-hmm. I really like his work. Clearly, I'm a Joni Mitchell fan from Ferris, from my Ferris days, from everything from there up to now.
Yeah.
And I think her inclination is like jazz now, too.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, music, my father was like a drummer. He was a musician.
Yeah.
So I heard all kinds of music at home. So I'm not really kind of wedded to...
Yeah. Was he a professional drummer? Or just liked to do it?
He just liked to do it, but he played a lot with a lot of bands and stuff. In fact, I found a book here, and I found his picture in the book on a bandstand. I think it was at the Bluebird on time. And,
do you remember those bands? What their names were?
No, I don't remember his band, but I can remember him getting ready to go out to play a gig.
Yeah.
Because his drums were in the basement. He would practice in the basement. Mm-hmm. But I remember watching him get ready. He'd be like shaving. And he dressed up. You know, they dressed when they went out, you know. Not like they do now. Yeah, so.
What was his name?
John Ziegler. John David Ziegler. Okay. Yeah, But I found this picture in the book. He didn't believe it. I said, look, Dad, you're in this book.
Was he proud?
I was.
Yeah.
I certainly was, you know, because I can remember him playing drums in the basement and, you know, just going down there and listening to him. I can remember watching him shave and getting ready and putting on my Old Spice and, you know. And I would say, oh, God, he's, like, really dressed up. Look at him. I thought maybe your attraction maybe started with your father.
It might be that, all of us.
Yeah.
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 Do you dress up nowadays? Do you put on a suit every now and then?
I do. Noel night, I had on a tie.
Really?
And a pressed shirt and my apron. I do that there all the time.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes I feel like, so why you put that tie? I said, because I feel like being that person today.
Mm-hmm.
And people will treat me every day. Are you the manager?
Yeah.
No. Are you the manager? Oh, you know, you look really nice today. Thank you. And I have my little bib thing on. I'm the barista. I'm the artist then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I do that, yeah. And I do that for me. Mm-hmm. That makes me feel good.
Yeah. So you were there on Saturday night?
I was there Saturday night.
Were you working Avalon?
Yes, I was,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how were people reacting? Could you hear any shooting? Or?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, we didn't.
You're way down there.
No. Okay. I think the shooting was over here on Kirby. And
it was Farnsworth and John Arnold.
Which is a long way. And we're like,
yeah.
But everything was fine over there. There was,
okay.
People were on the street. People, we were packed.
Yeah.
We were packed till like we had to close the door at 10 and say, all right, we're done.
Packed all night, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I thought, you know, we're talking about music. I'm around a lot of young people, and they're listening to a lot of stuff. I'm thinking, like, the stuff you guys listen to, I don't know how you listen to it. But somebody was telling me about, overheard them talking about, what's her name? Solange Knowles.
Oh, yes.
So I thought, all right, Atiba, I'm gonna go. I saw her on Saturday Night Live one time, and I thought, what is she doing? Whatever. Solange, whatever. So I just got to turn the TV off. So I thought, all right, you're gonna give it a try. You're gonna listen. So I put in the computer on YouTube, Cranes in the Sky. It's a great song. And so I found myself, I plugged in the whole album and listened to it. Mm-hmm. I forget what the name. Seat at the Table is the name of the album.
Okay. You know?
So I thought, like, that's really great. Seat at the Table. Everybody wants a seat at the table.
Yeah. Yeah. You feel like you got a seat at the table now?
I have a seat at the table now.
Yeah.
I am. You've always been at the table. Really? Yeah. I've always been at the table. I just didn't think I was. I just didn't think I was. But, yeah, I definitely have a seat at the table now. Yeah. So, you know, if I'm listening to anything, like, I'm going to say Solange is in my ear.
Yes.
Yeah. Solange, yeah. I would never think
this. You're coming back around. See, young Detroiters are still teaching.
Right.
And do you have anything to teach them, do you think, at this point?
I wonder.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a young guy that I work with, and I adore him.
Yes.
He's really a smart guy. Sometimes not smart in the right way I said, but you know, Atiba, you know, you're probably just like him. You probably were just like him. You just forgotten it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're just like him. And I don't think he thinks I have anything to give him, but I do. And I hope that I'm able to bridge that with him. I think he likes me. But I think I get on his nerves sometimes. He gets on my nerves sometimes. But I just adore him. I just adore him. I don't think he knows how much I do.
Yeah. What do you like about him? Is it because you can see yourself in him? Or is he different completely?
Because he's completely different from me. He's completely different. He's kind of, and I think he's riding the, you know, he says he's bisexual. He's got a beautiful girlfriend. Mm-hmm. But I've known some of his boyfriends since I've been there who are equally as beautiful.
Yeah.
But he's involved with this woman right now, and is, you know, they're both kind of activists, and they're working together, and I just love her.
Mm-hmm.
I adore her, you know. So I like that he's, and I know his life is different from mine. He's told me some things about his life, and I probably wouldn't, if I had been in his shoes, I probably would not have done well. But he's done pretty well. I mean, he's like probably like 35, but he buried his mother really early, and he must have stepped up and took the responsibility to do that, where his brothers didn't do it. And I think that's probably why we kind of have this tension, because he's had to like kind of man up at a really early age. So he's probably like, you know. And I also noticed, and that's the thing, I didn't talk about that with Ruth Ellis Center.
Mm-hmm.
I had a father at home. I think a lot of the young gay boys that were at the center that I had to deal with, and even Tristan, their fathers were not present for the probably the most significant part of their life. Probably not a lot at all. He was telling me his father left them and married somebody else, and his mother gets cancer, and he's like a kid. He's got to take care of his mother and do all this stuff. So my thing is, if there's a older figure, older male figure who comes up and tries to kind of like tries to show them, it's like, oh, you can't show me anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my father wasn't around. You know, how are you going to show me something? You know, guys like you, whatever.
Yeah.
So I think that figures with me and our relationship with him, I think that he kind of feels that kind of like, you know, you're an old guy, T, but get out of my face. I done this all myself with no help from no adult male, for no support. So, you know, get away from me.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, probably just like you when you were younger, if someone came along and tried to say, you know, Atiba, this is who you are, you got to flip that switch back on, you couldn't have heard it.
No,
it wasn't time.
I couldn't hear it at the court. I mean, when they were telling me, Atiba, you know, you got to kind of like, you know, you can't do that. I would question the judge when the judge make a decision. I'd be like, how did you make that decision? And they would seem like, Atiba, Kevin, can't do that. Why not? You know, so that's when I think about myself like Tristan, like kind of like that, you know.
Yeah.
I could be like that.
Yeah, we're all young ones.
Yeah, but I think also I really think that's really significant at the center of it. A lot of them couldn't listen to me because their dad wasn't home. Who are you going to, you're not telling me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
My father don't even tell me what to do. It's just me and my mother or whatever, so get out of my face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't like that. Get the fuck out of my face, Atiba. They would tell me that sometimes. But I'm an adult. You can talk to me. I mean, in my head, I'd be thinking like, well, he just told me to get the fuck out of his face.
Well, your parents, were generally supportive of you?
I think my parents, you know, my father never called me a sissy, never called me a fag or anything like that. I think he probably would have liked me to be in something different, but no, never. No, I think my parents were really supportive of me. Even when I came back when I went to the first National Black Gay and Lesbian Leadership Forum,
yeah.
I was 32. I came back and I kind of said, well, like, hey, you know, you guys, I think this, where did you go? And I said this because I was so empowered when I came back. I said, this is where I went. I said, really? That's where you went? I said, yeah, it was fantastic. And, you know, my mother said, well, you know, we always kind of knew who you were, you know. I think I was 38 when I did that, when I went to the conference. And my mother said, I kind of knew all the time. You know, before you quit that court job, I was begging your father to talk to you because I don't think that it was all of the work and everything at the court and the cases that was bothering you. I think it was mostly you just not being able to deal with who you were.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought, and I tried to get your father to talk to you, but he never did it. But I called my father up one time when I was like having that meltdown. The first time when I asked him for the time away from court, and I told him, like, we were crying and everything. He came over to my house, and he just kind of listened to me for a few minutes, and, you know, he said, like, all right, you're going to be all right, boy. That's all he said to me. It was like, what? I'm crying. I'm saying all this, so I don't know where my life is going. I'm saying, this is the kind of stuff I'm saying.
Yeah.
I don't know where my life is going. I don't know where it's going. I was a mess. And he was like, you'll be all right, boy. All right, I'm getting ready to go back home.
That's all he could get at that point.
That's all.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking, like, what?
Was he later able to give more?
I think he was just able to accept. My father, he was one of those persons who, his father didn't stick around.
Mm-hmm.
So my thing is, I'm not sure he exactly knew how to do all of that. He didn't know how to navigate all of that either. He was just kind of on the job training.
Mm-hmm.
He did a good job. He was supportive of me. I think he loved me, but he never said anything bad about me being gay. When I kind of came out and he'd meet my boyfriends or whatever, he'd be respectful to them, nice, come on in, have something to eat. You want something to drink? That was my father, you know. They'd go out and back and have a cigarette and talk or something, whatever, you know. It was like, you know, yeah.
That's
so
huge. To some people, that's impossible.
Yeah, you know, like I said, those were my parents, so they were okay. They accepted my friends and stuff. Now my sisters, they're kind of on the fence.
Mm-hmm.
Both of my sisters, they become church ladies.
Mm-hmm.
More than my mother wasn't even a church lady, so. They, you know, they believe that Bible. One's a Jehovah's Witness, and one is like goes to some other church. You know, she'll say stuff like, you know, I'm caring for an 87-year-old uncle, my father's brother, who's like in a rehab center. I had to put him in a rehab center maybe 2 years ago. But he's gay.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Born in 1920, 1931, I think he was born. No, 1929.
Yeah.
He's a student here.
Okay.
What's his name? John Angry.
Okay.
He's had a really tough life, you know. He's had a tough walk, mm-hmm. and probably because he was gay, and he's told me some stuff that just made me so sad sometimes, you know. But my father had a gay brother, so it's like my father knew his brother was gay, mm-hmm. you know, and they kind of accepted him. So I guess he kind of had some kind of experience, so he knew, because he would have to get him out of jail and stuff like that. Vice would pick him up or something mm-hmm. like that. Yeah. So, but he never said anything bad to me or anything. They were very supportive of me. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that is. That's a lot. Yeah. That's a lot.
So that's chapter one of your life.
Right. That's chapter one, yeah.
Thank you for sharing it.
All right, thanks.